Welcome to the Rainbow Room,
our podcast about writing, representation,
and gay stuff.
This is episode 34, Outstanding, a Comedy Revolution.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Rainbow Room. I am here with today's guest, Roger Q. Mason.
Mason is in the Rainbow Room, honey.
Ooh! Oh my god, I'm so excited to have you. Okay, so Roger is super prolific. You just finished a like 3-play tour or something like that.
Been on tour, honey. I mean, I started in February in San Francisco with a play of mine called The Pride of Lions.
Okay.
Then I went to the regional premiere of Lavender Men in Chicago. And then I went to the world premiere of The Duot in Philadelphia. Then after that, I came back here to LA to do a reading of my new play about Bayard Rustin called Night Cities.
Oh my God.
Then I did a project with Larry Powell, the great Emmy-winning Larry Powell. And we did something called the Passion Project on the CBS lot. So I was over there at Television City. And then after all of that, now I have to do rewrites and I'm getting ready to go to New York because I have a reading in August of another show of mine called The Pink. So I'll be leaving in a couple of weeks for that. So
you were just cranking them out. Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's a wonderful world.
You know. And so all these plays, just to clarify, you wrote all of them.
I wrote all of those pieces, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are you also acting in all of them?
No, I'm not. But I get requests all the time. So The Pink in New York, I will be reprising that role. So I'll start there. The Pink is... The subtitle of The Pink used to be An Intimacy Ritual, and it's basically a play about two people who go on a one-night stand that becomes this transcendent sexual and existential experience.
Oh my God.
And there's a song from the 70s called Star Love, and it's about the cosmic power of sex. And that's where those two go. So I'll be playing the ingenue, you know, because everyone loves an innocent girl like Miss Mason.
Yeah.
And then actually Pierre-Jean Gonzalez, who was in Hamilton for a long time, will be playing the lover, a Herman.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's a sort of a play on words because there's Mel, which is my character, and her man. So we just called him Herman. That's how we got the name.
That's so silly.
Yeah, it's crazy. So that's what that is. And I love that piece because it's a follow-up to Lavender Men. It posits the question, what if Taffeta got her way and had that beautiful intimacy with a man that she dreams about while eavesdropping on Abe Lincoln's affair with his legal assistant? Because that's what Lavender Men is about. It's about this contemporary narrator who sort of is a voyeur into the past with this gay love affair between Abe Lincoln and his legal secretary. And she kind of gets a little wet and imagines what it would be like to have that kind of intimacy for herself. So I wrote a follow-up piece. What if that type of person, we don't call this one Taffeta, we call her Mel. Mm-hmm. What if this type of person did go on that date?
Ooh.
And what would happen to them?
Okay, yeah. So going back to Lavender Men, that's one about Lincoln, right?
Right.
Can that be viewed other than live?
So you're in luck.
Oh.
Because we actually adapted it for feature film.
Okay.
In the same year, on the same stage, under different circumstances from the world premiere. So we world premiered the piece in 2022.
Okay.
Here in Los Angeles at Skylight Theater.
Oh, cool.
And we retained the same actors, including myself. And then we used that set as sort of a chamber drama set for this film adaptation of the play. And so our premiere of the film is going to be an Out South Queer Film Festival in Durham, North Carolina. I'll be there in August.
Oh my God.
And then I think there's going to be some showings around the country coming up soon. So people watch out because Miss Mason's on the move and we're in the movies. So that's what's going on right now.
That's so exciting. Okay. So I want to briefly mention a couple things. Because I wanted to get back to talking about Lavender Men. But also this episode today is going to be about the kind of the piece of media we're concentrating on is Outstanding, A Comedy Revolution on Netflix, which you are in, which is super cool.
Yeah. So the way that happened was in the process of promoting Lavender Men, the play, mm-hmm. in 2022, I met the fabulous Dave Holmes, who, of course, is editor of Esquire, but was also in the early stages of working on a documentary about queer comedians.
Whoa.
With Paige Hurwitz. And it was the height of the pandemic. So there was a lot of, like, craziness going on. Who can be in the studio filming when? How? So Dave said, look, you're a funny girl. You know enough about comedy. We want to get you on camera to talk about. Specifically, they asked me at that time to talk about Moms Mabley. Now, I know that I'm going to be speaking to an intergenerational audience on this podcast, you know, because I'm not 20 anymore. So,
you could fool me.
Well, look at you. Flattering me already. 5 minutes in. Child. Okay. I'm
seeing Andrew. You look very young, yes. Well,
thank you, darling. I'm not, though. But, Moms Mabley was a pioneer of the comedy world. She started in the 1920s in vaudeville as a black lesbian out woman in comedy.
And so, and what year?
The 1920s.
Oh, I can't imagine.
100 years ago.
I didn't even know it was possible to come out when you were in 1920.
I was out wearing three-piece suits, not giving a fuck. And she sort of evolved this character of this crazy, zany grandmother character that she started playing when she was still in her 20s, but did it through the rest of her career. This character would say anything. Mm. I mean, anything about politics, about civil rights, about queer issues. I mean, and from that mask, she got away with it all.
Mm.
It was using the principles of that mask to be able to draw a satirical line straight at the heart of America, to show how ridiculous this country is from within itself. And Moms, and I'll tell you about Moms, I would listen to, there was this tape, a cassette tape. Now, for those of y'all that don't know what a cassette tape is, Google that shit. Don't ask me what a cassette tape is. You can Google it. I have this cassette tape from Chess Records called The Funniest Woman in the World. And it was a compilation of some of her best.
Oh, you are not as young as I thought you were. You had the cassette tape.
I told you, child. I told you. Mother is seasoned. Mother is well seasoned. So I would listen to this cassette tape. I'm old enough to have bought the cassette tape multiple times, not just have it given to me. I bought it firsthand. Mm. Lost it. This cassette tape was of her best performances. And I committed them to memory.
Whoa.
They were comfort. They were inspiration. They were transportation. They were education. They formed my understanding of art, of how to tell a good story, of how to make people laugh, and of how to critique a structure from within itself. And my work as a writer in my own right is deeply satirical. And I think a lot of that has to do with what I learned listening to Moms.
Wow.
Critiquing society through the guise of laughter.
That is so cool.
So he brought me in to talk about Moms, but then he asked me a whole bunch of other questions. I had no idea, because you have to understand we were in a booth and it was a whole thing. And the director was actually off, you know, off site giving notes on Zoom. So all of this was in a vacuum and I had no idea. So
Wait, the director was giving notes on Zoom?
Like giving us instructions and stuff from Zoom.
Like directing the scene via remote?
Right, right.
That is wild.
That was the time.
That is such a...
Miss COVID.
Oh.
Miss COVID. You know, this is 2022 that this was happening.
That's so wild.
So, like, you just speak, you know? You don't know what you're saying or what it's going to be used for. And then, like any gig, you forget it. So a couple of years went by and I received these emails from Netflix like, oh, the movie is coming out and the premiere is at the first premiere was at Tribeca. So they were trying to get me to come to that. But I was at my other premiere that night of the Duet, so I couldn't be in two places at once. I literally had two premieres on the same night, one at Tribeca and one in Philadelphia at the Duet.
You're like, sorry, I'm booked.
Baby, she busy. Sorry about it. We will catch you on the next one.
So I wish I could be there.
But I have another show. So then they said, fine, L.A., doing it at the Egyptian Theater. So they brought me out. I was already here. I was home. I went to that premiere, and I met Paige Hurwitz in person. And I was so flattered because she said, you know, you your voice and your knowledge base and your enthusiasm became a kind of through line for me.
Oh.
And so that's why I had so much airtime in that piece. Because she really took a liking to how I would frame ideas around people and people around ideas and moments around people and ideas. It's this constant cyclical understanding of life. And that's just how I live.
That's amazing. Yeah, you do make several appearances throughout the documentary, and you're so well spoken and well poised. You sound like a hired historian when you talk.
You know, I think, you know, as a playwright and the work that I do specifically, I kind of am a lay historian.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know, I my formal training is in English and theater, but my interest has always been in revisionist history. How do we tell the stories that are silenced or cast aside by society because they are contrary to the status quo?
Wow. Oh, I love that.
How do I give voice to the voiceless? How do I use my work and my body, the instrument of my artistry, as a tool for freedom? That is what I do as a writer and as a storyteller. And that sensibility has always been at the forefront of how I write. It was amazing many years ago, 20 years ago, when I started in this business, I would talk about the power of history and how important and essential it was for us to maintain a healthy, rigorous, and constant relationship to our past in order to, one, prevent the bad parts of it from repeating, but also to take lessons of survival from those times for the future. I can't tell you the number of times that my work or the essays surrounding my work were rejected because no one wanted to hear about history. Now, here we are in a moment where history is being erased, where we are banning books, where we are rolling back laws that took decades, sometimes hundreds of years, of great sacrifice, blood, sweat, and tears shed on American soil to find little shreds of dignity and respect for our fellow human, all being taken away by a couple of politicians and a few bought and paid for justices of the court. Now, more than ever, I am in business and I am needed. Now, more than ever, work like mine is an urgent necessity for the survival of humanity. I don't take that responsibility lightly. I don't look upon that work with any sense of lightness or whimsy. I know that the people need the truth. I have an obligation to leave a record for the next generation. Some of these motherfuckers is lost that are living and breathing right now. I'm not worried about them. I'm worried about who's here that's ready to hear the truth here and now, and how can we save the babies here to come? I need to leave a record of how we got here, what tools of community, of self-reliance, of ingenuity, of perseverance did we build in the here and now, sometimes under cover of darkness, sometimes for fear and threat of erasure. We built these hovels of hope so that somebody else 50 years from now could say, we will make it too, because they did it then.
Hell yeah. Man, that was powerful stuff. You are so poetic. That's amazing.
It's all in the day's work.
And I'm inspired. Yeah. Well, I think on that beautiful note, let's take our break and watch this show. And I can't wait to even ask you more questions.
Yay!
Let's watch the show. And we're back. Woo!
Andrew, you needed a break.
yeah. Hey, I was very inspired by what you said. I needed a minute to go like journal and go on a journey of self-reflection.
And you did all of that. Okay, you did all of that. And, you know, the thing is, I only tell the truth.
Yeah, I've noticed. Yeah.
As I see it.
Yeah.
Unapologetically. And it took me a long time to be that person. It took me a long time to get to the place in my own inner constitution where I could just sit up and deliver the truth.
Really?
Yes.
Were you pretty inspired? I mean, so, you know, outstanding. There's all these, it shows all these comics that came before us, yeah, and comedians and playwrights and et cetera. And I know you listen to Moms a lot. Is that Would you say that really helped?
It was my guiding light. Mm. Comedy was my guiding light because the audacity that a comic can embrace through the guise of hilarity is second to none. You can literally get away with anything as long as you're making people laugh. But, you know, they say that the clown is the saddest man in the room because, for me, he holds the secret to the human condition, which is that he understands exactly, acutely, why you suffer. You suffer because you're ridiculous. That's why. And he's laughing at you, but he's laughing with you, and he's laughing through you, and he's laughing next to you, all at the same time. And that much social laughter is tiring. So one of the things you learn on that documentary is the cost that a lot of these people had to pay for telling the truth about what it meant to be queer in America in the times in which they lived.
Yeah.
Some of them, careers shifted or got blacklisted or were stunted, you know, because they dared to be honest. And then others, depending on the time period in which they were making work, took that same mantle, and it became a beacon of momentum and success for them because the times have changed.
Yeah.
But it's not because of comes out of a vacuum. It doesn't come out of a vacuum. It's the sacrifices every day that people make in their respective lanes to pave a way for the next generation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what was watching the documentary. That's what was so fascinating about it for me, was that Paige as director had assembled a panoramic expression of intergenerational comics.
Yeah.
The work that they had done and the contributions that they had made across the decades to get us to where we are now.
Yeah, it's actually, it's really fascinating for me. So, you know, as a gay stand-up comedian, some of the, I draw inspiration from people like Mateo Lane and Joel Kim Booster and a couple others that aren't in the special, like Caleb Herron and Jay Jordan. I also find very, Dylan Adler, you know, but it's really interesting to see them and talk about the queer comedians that came before them that inspired them. Because it's so funny because I'm like, oh, I'm looking up to you. But yeah, obviously you had to look up to other people when you were coming up. And it's interesting to hear like what historic gay or queer comedians people were looking up to. And there's something very wholesome about that kind of like, yeah, as you said, generation from generation, we're like learning lessons from the generation before us or drawing inspiration or drawing courage and bravery from like, okay, they did it. I can do it, you know? Yeah, I think that's really cool.
You know, who really touched me and intrigued me in that piece was Eddie Izzard.
Oh, yeah.
Because I didn't really know all of that about the Eddie Izzard story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they are quite the innovator. Certainly decades and decades before their time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're in a day and age where trans and gender nonconforming folks are starting to see visibility and some semblance of acceptance in the world. Certainly not everywhere, and certainly not in all contexts, but we're starting to win that fight slowly because of the contributions of folks like Eddie Izzard, who sort of looked with a laser-sharp wit at how ridiculous the world is. You know, that creates binaries and limitations for people's expansion and imagination. You know, I find myself to be very blessed to be a gender nonconforming person. And the reason why is because I think I possess the imagination, the sexual, social, and political imagination to transcend the physical world.
Yeah, I think Eddie Izzard is actually, I want to check out more of their stuff, a really interesting case study because, as you said, has been doing comedy for a long time, has been pushing these boundaries for a long time. But also, you know, I've met people who aren't queer at all, and Eddie is one of their favorite comedians.
Mm-hmm.
And that is always really cool because they're able to, like, communicate about issues, be their authentic self, and still not alienate probably the audience that needs to hear it most, right? So,
you know, what... And you're getting into a conversation about what it means to pursue the mainstream.
Mm.
And, you know, for the first maybe 10 years of my career, I said, fuck the mainstream. Mm-hmm. They don't understand. They're not worth it. Mm-hmm. The next 10, I maybe spent saying, okay, who am I and what is my mainstream? And now in this third decade of my work, I'm interested in a new question, which is, how can we build a story for each other? Not worrying about what's mainstream and what's not. How can we just tell an honest human story? And it's been amazing. You know, all of these plays that you mentioned at the beginning of this episode, the audience responses to the work has been one of extreme gratitude. That I have written work that gives people license to feel seen. And that has been across age, racial, demographic, professional, all different aspects of human participation in the world. Everybody has come across at these different projects and said, thank goodness you wrote that. To achieve that kind of universality is not easy. It's a very meticulous set of tricks that you have to play. Not easy. And to do it over and over again, creating perhaps a formula, although I'm not that maniacal about it, you know, that's a gift and a blessing. And it's a rarity in our profession, you know, to be able to write work that is consistently appealing and yet authentic to you and yet speaking quite, you know, strongly to various people at the same time. It's not easy.
Yeah. So what do you think the secret is? Because it sounds like you weren't necessarily targeting something that would have mainstream appeal, but you're saying you're still able to appeal to audiences across all demographics. Is it?
Honesty. Honesty.
Yeah.
Vulnerability. And and humility. The power of collaboration. How do I work with people who know more than I do? How do I have the honesty enough to admit what I don't know and ask for help? How do I allow critics into my world? People who are not just affirming my way of saying things or doing things, but saying, well, what about this? Well, have you thought about that? Well, you know, this may not work over here if you do. Well, you know, someone might say, and creating a panorama of critique and then being objective about, okay, well, I'm going to look at this and this, and maybe we'll do a little bit of this. And that's not for me. That question will leave unanswered.
Okay.
And if I get, you know, but this will address here. Maybe that, you know, and really thinking very holistically about what the story is that you're telling and how you're going to tell it. And sometimes saying, you know what? I'm not here to please everybody. Always saying that, actually. I'm not here to please everybody. That's not my work. That's not my ministry. I'm just going to tell the truth.
I love that.
You know, and I think that from that place, I've been able to create a way of working that has been consistent. And I'm very grateful to have found it at this time. Because now the factory's moving. Because, you know, once you have a lot of work like this, now people want to start working with you. So you have to bring yourself wherever you go. Well, if you didn't know who you were, then what in the hell were you going to bring?
Ooh, oh my God. You just scared me. Yeah, I forgot who I am. Yeah.
If you don't know who you are, then what are you bringing on the journey, honey? What are you bringing on the journey?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, and I don't know the answer to that because I'm not, when I get into the room and I know I'm telling the truth, I'm able to look on it slightly, but I also, I'm not studying it. Mm-hmm. I'm just there. Yeah. We're just doing. It's just happening. I don't study that. And then the minute it's done, boom, next. So there's a man outside with no shirt on. Child, go ahead and look. Yes, that's the camera that we need to be pointed.
Oh my God.
Anyway, he might be your neighbor. You might want to find out later what he's doing, honey. Because that's worth an investigation. Let me tell you that. You all should have seen that. Anyway, we're talking about honesty. What
were well, that saying? Was very honest. That
it was. I got to go, you're looking at me like, what the fuck is this bitch looking at? You know, it's a hot Sunday. And, you know, we're over here just two steps from West Hollywood. So the children are thirsty. So they're walking the streets, you know. They're looking for water. I don't know.
Oh, I might be able to quench their thirst. Anyway.
Oh. Or they may be able to quench yours. You never know in this world. Okay, that's the truth. I see fields of green. And clouds of white.
Okay, so actually this is a question I've been very eager to ask you, and I think you're kind of touching on it with the way you approach your work and your writing honest work and consistently well-performing work now.
Consistent high performance.
Yeah.
To an extent, the writer is a business person and has to look at themselves in that way. To an extent, they're town crier. To an extent, they're the bleeding heart of the human condition. All in one body, thinking, and you have to be balanced between them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be one and not address the others, because that's not long lasting.
Okay.
But what were you going to ask?
I was going to ask how, for our listeners and for myself included, who want to tell our own queer stories, who want to get more queer stories out into the world, writing the story is one thing, but also you're being given opportunities to showcase your work, you're meeting high profile people who are able to connect you with these opportunities. How has that happened to you? I guess maybe let's take a step back. What's your origin story? How did you start kind of in this field and gaining momentum?
Well, you were talking about getting your stuff out into the world. Mm-hmm. And I think the first thing is to define what is the world to you?
Mm-hmm.
Who are your people? You know, my origin story, there's many origin stories of who I am and how I do what I do. But I want to tell this origin story today. I really found this particular moment that I'm in now during the pandemic, when I was working as a mentor through the New Visions Fellowship, giving opportunities to emerging Black trans playwrights who were looking for artistic but also professional mentorship. And in helping them, I found myself.
Whoa.
I found the power of motherhood, matrimony, of maternity and modernity and positivity. How do I find that beautiful marriage between being relevant to people, giving of myself to them, and helping them nurture who they are?
Mm.
And in doing that, maybe finding my higher purpose. When you find your higher purpose, everything else falls into place. It helps people read you clearly. People understand you. You're not just some seeking aspirant hoping to be heard. You're a person on a mission with a story to tell and something to offer to other people.
Yeah, I think that's key. It sounds like you're not coming from a place of, oh, please give me an opportunity. You're coming from a place of, like, y'all need this and I have it, and y'all need the story I have to tell. Like, that's kind of, it's more of like, I have a gift. I'm not trying to beg for stage time.
I have never begged, because no one has ever listened to such a beg. I know that I am a very polarizing person. I know that I can be seen as, in some circles and under some circumstances, as unavailable or perhaps intimidating, because people have trouble hearing the truth.
Mm.
They would rather hide in a lie than live with the truth. So that scares some people off.
Mm.
Hmm. Now, for those that are emotionally evolved, open, and ready for transformation, my goodness, have I got a world to show you. It's infinite in possibilities and fertile beyond your wildest dreams, because it's within you. You are the field and the fertilizer. You are the host and the guest in that world. You are the supplicant and the blesser, all in one body. The whole universe exists within you. And all you have to do is one thing. Tell yourself the truth. Who am I? And what do I want to give to this world? When I was in 10th grade, my history teacher said, at the end of the year, I will tell you all the secret of life. So at the end of May, I had written in my calendar book, because, I'm a Capricorn and that's what I do. I said, ask him what's the secret of life. He had forgotten. He's probably bullshitting us and didn't really have an answer if I look at it now. But I held him to his word.
And I said, you promised us that you would tell us at the end of the year what is the secret of life, and I'd like you to share it with us. He said, all right. The secret of life is to leave this world better than how it was when you came into it. Mm. Now, I was, what, 15 years old? And that's what I learned. So every day I think about how can we use this work as a vessel of transformation? How can we question the systems that are holding us down and holding us back and make a way for change? Because it's all useful. It's all a tool. You know, the theater is the seeing place and the cinema is the mind refracted back to us. Mm-hmm. We're going to these places in order to see ourselves. We're going to these places to have our lived experiences reflected back to us so that we can model a way of living in the world in our imagination. At night, when we dream, we play a movie in our head subconsciously, some recent memories and some ages old, and we replay that past in order to plan how we're going to react in the future. So we're all historians biologically. Mm-hmm. So fuck the assholes 20 years ago that weren't interested in me telling my stories in the ways that I told them. They just weren't dreaming.
Ooh, actually, that's a really good segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask you. You know, a big thing that you pointed out kind of in this documentary is how people had to kind of make sacrifices in order to tell their authentic story.
Yes.
And so I wanted to ask you, as a Black nonconforming person and Filipino, right?
Yes, my mother's from the Philippines.
Okay. What has your experience been with that? Have you faced, it sounds like you have faced maybe some loss of opportunities from choosing to be authentic, or has it been sacrificed? Has it helped you or not even helped you, but like, how's that played into everything?
I find that the marketplace is a reflection of the market and the marketers. So when there's scarcity in the world or when there's a feeling of risk in the world, our theaters, our institutions reflect that back. Mm. So places that seem to do well with my work are ones that embrace the power of improvisation, collaboration, and inspiration. Places that find a way, even where there might not be that many resources, to find innovations or pivots, as we said in the pandemic. What's the pivot? Mm. You know, that's the type of place that I think does well with my work. The others run the other way, out of fear and discomfort. I say you have to learn how to embrace discomfort because life is not entirely comfortable. Life is uncomfortable, mm-hmm. Okay? You feel pain so that you know you're alive. You know you're alive because you feel pain. Huh. That's discomfort right there. How do you find a way of living in some kind of harmony or inner peace when you are constantly managing discomfort? I say you look within and you also look outside. You know, that feeling of communal healing is at the center of the work I write, and it's the types of places that foster that environment that do the best when collaborating with me. And I am able to contribute something positive to those places because now we have a meeting of the minds.
Yeah.
I'm not having to translate or fight through their own worries about insecurity and scarcity. If there's one thing I don't like in this world, it's a can't-do attitude. Oh, I can't do this. I can't do that. Get out of here. I have zero tolerance for pessimism. Mm. There are videos of people, fascinating people in other countries on Instagram that I've seen with no arms who have made full-on crepes with their toes, child. Open the can, crack the eggs and everything.
Whoa.
Chopped the thing. Anything is possible if you put your mind to it. But the moment that you close your mind to opportunity, the moment that you succumb to difficulty, you are going to die spiritually and perhaps physically too, slowly or right away. Mm. You must live in hope.
Yeah.
I have lived in hope. I spent every day of my life living in the infinite glory of hope. Why? Because without that, I would have been gone already. There is so much pain and so much discomfort and so much disappointment in the world that it's so easy for us to fall into the deep, dark corners of depression and fall apart. And I have chosen not to. I have been blessed in that ability to transcend through positivity and community and purpose. They call it ikigai in Japan. What is your larger purpose? And it's one of the principles that they talk about in these blue zones. They found that people in Japan who are 100 years old and plus, one of the reasons why they tend to live so long is because they possess ikigai, some larger purpose.
Whoa.
Literally, having a reason to live makes you live. Having a reason to live keeps you living.
Not the camera look. Like, you hear that?
Y'all got that? You know? And that's really how I function. Yeah. You know? So I don't worry about the places that have caused me difficulty. I know I'm polarizing. They start running the minute I show up. That's that aura.
That is so funny to me because, like, having met you and talking to you for literally 2 seconds, immediately you're so inviting, you're so warm. You do not give off a confrontational energy, although I'm sure you do confront issues if you're faced with them.
Right.
But, like, it doesn't seem like you're naturally coming from a place of being here to fight.
Sometimes we ain't trying to fight. We trying to function, first of all. Second of all, people that are afraid, when they encounter someone who's very sure of themselves, that rattles their insecurity.
Ooh.
They have to run. They start running immediately. You know, I was doing a conversation recently, and I'd said some things on that talk that were triggering to somebody who was worried about pleasing other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what their comment was. And I said, you should never worry about pleasing other people because you'll never please them, because their pleasure moves from time to time and moment to moment and man to man. Chasing after somebody else's joy is the wrong way to live. Don't you know that person shut the hell down? Couldn't look me in the face for the rest of that time of interaction. Could not look me in the face. Why? Because I touched on something very primally amiss in their spirit, which is that they know that they derive their worth from other people, and that is a house that cannot stand. You see, early on, and this is maybe we keep cycling back to these origin stories, I learned early on that I wasn't going to please everybody because I was a very controversial figure. When I was in preschool.
Oh, preschool?
We're going to preschool for a second. I was in preschool and they used to have mandatory naps at that time. So I went and I questioned the instructor. I said, my grandmother is paying you to teach me not to watch me sleep. Why are we sleeping? I can do that at home. They held me in that preschool for another year until they saw me asleep. They didn't realize I was sitting there counting how many, and I left that. But I said to my grandmother, they lie to you. They don't teach. They lie. To be punished at 3 years old for questioning a system of authority and its effectiveness was a great instruction to me that I would spend a life questioning other people and sometimes being admonished for it. At 3 years old, I learned that lesson, that I would always be questioning authority and standing up for what I knew was right, and sometimes they would try and silence me for it, even by making me sleep.
Wow. I mean, it's funny because you're right. It's a preschool story, but that kind of lesson does have large ramifications.
It has monumental ramifications. Now, everyone else, of course, went to bed. Some of them liked sleeping. And look, that's why I, to this day, don't nap, I think. I do not nap. I do not. I wake up and I pound the pavement and I hustle in these streets until I can't take it anymore. And then I turn on Judge Judy and fall asleep on her ass too. And then I'm out. But I cannot, for the life of me, I cannot nap. Every now and then, maybe once a year, I push it to the point where the body's like, bitch, sit your ass down. And I'm out for like 15 minutes. And it's the strangest feeling in the world. the strangest feeling in the world. And then after that, I'm like, oh, we can't be doing that. I don't know why you did that, girl. What was that about? And then I'm back up and I'm back on the move. But I think that's why I don't nap. But imagine being 3 years old and learning that lesson. And it went on from there, you know, through elementary school, through high school, then learning I was, you know, same sex attracted for a while, then learning that actually I was more than that, then learning that my, you know, gender expression was contrary to the binary, learning what a binary was. I didn't know, you know, then learning that there was life outside of such a thing, learning that the way that I structure my plays or the subjects that I talk about are not savory for certain programmers because they're not their perception of what's marketable. Then finding out that actually the work I needed to do was exactly what we needed to do. And the fools that were suppressing it the whole time contributed to how we got to this moment. The amnesia, for fear of what? For fear of losing a dollar, for fear of keeping your doors open for one moment, just to have that ephemeral thrill that for a day I survived. I survived on the backs of other people whom I silenced. I survived because I made that three-year-old bitch go to sleep. And because of that, I kept my job today. You may have kept your job today, but you have eroded your spirit for tomorrow. Mm. And see, it doesn't take one word from me to elicit that kind of triggering apprehension in someone who lives a lie. Mm-hmm. Someone who lives a lie knows immediately, ooh, there's the light. I've got to go run for the darkness. Yeah. They feel it. I had a man say, I was just standing somewhere. I was at some bar. I think I was in New Mexico. And some man, I was just standing. I wasn't doing anything. Just standing there talking to some people. Some man came up to me, said, were you always a bitch or were you born this way? And I said, darling, I believe those two are one and the same thing. And he walked off, ran out the room cursing at the street. People that do not feel good about themselves can't stand fucking with me because they know one thing. I bring the radical gift of joy. And not everybody's ready to truly live in enjoyment. Joy is a great responsibility. You know, we talk about, oh, queer joy, different kinds of joy. To know joy also means to understand pain. Mm-hmm. To understand pain means to embrace discomfort. Unless you understand those low places, how will you truly say, thank goodness I have joy? That's the lesson. That's the blessing. That's the ministry. That's the work. That's the story. That's the origin.
Yeah, that's really, it's impressive to see the way that you take in your life and learn from it. I think it's really cool.
I don't even know how we got there, child.
I know.
You better ask something whimsical because we got we got deep in the mix, honey.
Yeah, well, I have two questions for you, and I think maybe this one's a little less, or a little more whimsical, maybe. So you were part of this documentary project, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't see the other interviews. So when you watched the Netflix show, that was your first time seeing a lot of that for the first time, right?
It was my first time seeing any of it.
How'd you like it?
I thought it was brilliant. I mean, I thought it was such a complete and full exploration of the story of queer comedy in this country from various perspectives. I thought it was an important record of how we got to this moment. And, you know, the censorship and the erasure and the abuse and neglect that a lot of those people went through in those different times, particularly the section in the 80s, we are unfortunately at risk of repeating that moment. Mm-hmm. And thinking about artists like Sandra Bernhardt and her sort of, you know, parody and protest work in the 80s that they showed in the documentary is a powerful record for young comedians, comedians like you, to sit up and say, how can I fight the power through laughter? I mean, we need that kind of work more than ever right now.
Yeah.
This is frightening, the times in which we live. There is nothing funny about the time in which we live, and yet it's absolutely ridiculous. It's the most laughable set of circumstances I've ever seen in my life. I was reading something that some senator, I think in Wisconsin, was saying, we should go back to the days before women could hold a credit card in their own name.
A senator said this?
Yes.
A U.S. senator.
U.S. senator. I think from Wisconsin. I can't remember.
Oh, woof.
I mean, first of all, the banks aren't going to have that because who the hell racks up these credit cards? It's women. So, shit, the banks are going to say, well, fuck you, dumbass. It's not going to help me lose business over your antiquated ways of being in the world just because you have to manifest some kind of, perform masculinity that's dependent on someone else relenting or acquiescing to your quote unquote power doesn't mean that I'm going to stop getting my interest on these damn credit cards.
Yeah.
Shit. You know, I mean, this is ridiculous. I'm going to say this, and I don't know why I'm compelled to say this on here. I think we're back in a gender war. I think we've made such beautiful progress. And I think queer people have been at the forefront of it.
Sure.
And I think the opposition to that innovation is fearful that they will be erased. But really what they need to do is they need to just come to the orgy, honey. Stop. Quit fighting it. Quit fighting it and just bring your Speedos and show up because we are fun, girl.
Yeah.
You know what? We have a great time over here. We have a fabulous time in Queer Town, let me tell you.
It is so funny, like, meeting you versus watching on the documentary, because on the documentary, all you see is a very, poised, professional, historic, almost like a historian. And then I meet you and you're talking about, like, oh, yeah, I wrote a play about what it would be like to have sex with Lincoln. Like,
well, you know, it's interesting. I was looking at myself in that documentary and I could feel the weight of the pandemic.
Interesting.
Because I had been 2 years cloistered.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see it. And it wasn't my first documentary experience. Because
mm-hmm.
I'd been a part of a couple of them a few years before that. But I think I understood the weight and the importance of that documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get it right in a way. And, you know, a lot happened to me from 2022 till now. You know, I have had many shows to go up and many opportunities in different capacities. And I think if I were to do that documentary now, I would sit in my skin in a different way.
Interesting.
You know, not to say that that person, there was anything wrong with that person. That was a beautiful depiction of who I was at that time.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating to me to chart the evolution of my own self-confidence and of my own outward self-expression by looking at that and comparing that with me now, sitting here, you know. The radical shift in my embrace of gender queerness and my ascent to motherhood as a mentor and educator has, I think, changed how I present myself.
I love that.
You know?
Congrats on that journey for you. That's
listen,
awesome.
And the journey continues.
Yeah.
I teach at Cal Arts now, and it's so gratifying to me to be able to share the beauty of global theater, which is the class that we have over there, and to watch those kids teach me, to watch them with all of their innovations and understandings of the world educate me. That is power. The kids, when you can transfer roles, when teacher becomes student and student becomes teacher, that is the mark of evolution. That means you as the teacher have come full circle. Your message has gotten to the next generation. And I think to an extent, as a storyteller, that's what we're seeking to do, is create a record of who we were and what our times were so that somebody else will know that we exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our fountain of youth. It's our elixir for immortality. That's at least one reason, I think, why people write work. It's certainly one reason why people grasp for power, you know, in whatever capacity, whether it's artistic power, political power, social power, sexual power. They want for one moment to feel like they can make time stop and be on top. It's that ephemeral joy. It's that dopamine rush, you know?
Yeah.
It's that feeling that can't really fully be described, that for one moment, I've touched the divine, you know? They used to call climax, sexual climax, le petit mort, the little death.
I heard that recently. I learned that recently, yeah.
You know? And I think there's something about being able to touch the divine through moments of pleasure and joy, whether they're physical or metaphysical,
mm-hmm.
social, professional. We're seeking that feeling. But to an extent, the skeptic, the scientist, the STEM kid would say it's just a firing of hormones. But I think there's more to it than that. I believe there's something cosmically at work, since we're made of stardust anyway. You know, I believe there's something cosmically at work when we reach for those moments. The question is, what do you do when you get there? And how constructively do you pursue it? You know, I remember, oh, child, there was one man I was chasing after. And I was like, oh, child, I had found myself drinking and smoking for a man. Changed myself for a brief moment just to reach him. And I said, if he is causing you to devolve your principles, is that really the ideal that you should be reaching for? First of all, why is he being called the ideal?
Yeah.
Second of all, why is the ideal that you're seeking ruining everything else that's going on outside of it? So you have to let that kind of stuff go. You know, it's interesting to me to watch people who look to me and my work as some sort of act of bravery, because I think so many of us worry about what other people think. Many of us have to, you know, in certain work contexts, there's certain things you can't say or certain ways you can't conduct yourself. And I have simultaneously in my life existed at the center of conversation and on the fringes at the same moment. Why? Because I tell the truth. The truth is both at the heart of a matter and always cast to the side.
You know, this segues, I think, into a question I wanted to ask. And we've kind of touched on this earlier, too. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the past and the present.
Yes.
So I want to ask you about the future and kind of a couple things. What projects are you working on now? And we've also talked about how there's some issues in the world, how comedy can be an agent for change, not just comedy, playwriting, work in general, the stories, right? What do you see as kind of your current mission that you're pursuing now, the future, what work you want to create, what work you think needs to be created? What should we as artists be kind of targeting in the future? And what work do you have that's coming out, including the play that you have is reading for now?
Yeah. You know, in terms of the future of theater specifically, something I'm excited about is returning to the idea of happenings. Happenings were sort of performance events that occurred primarily in the 60s and 70s. Many of them were site-specific. Many of them were related in some way to the spaces in which they existed. And they were always very ephemeral, and they were sought after. I think audiences sitting in a dark room watching something passively, Netflix has replaced that form of escapism. So now live performance work is about creating a culture around an event and a happening. You know, think about why people go to a Beyoncé concert. It's a multi-sensory experience where they feel treasured and seen as individuals. So it's not about Beyoncé singing to you. It's about how did you feel while she's singing and you're bearing witness to it and participating in it. There's a lot to be learned from the music business and particularly from these tours about how to engage audiences in returning to the theater specifically. Now, in terms of thinking about filmmaking, what's exciting to me is as the studios continue to buy each other up. Ooh, child. And writers continue to fight valiantly for their just due. We are still in various labor fights around this country. We are in a war for equal pay for laborers. Okay. As that's all happening, the spirit of independent art making is returning in a very significant way, because I think you can create a platform for your work anywhere now. We've decentralized definitions of success. You know, we've decentralized landing places for successful work. The work is successful wherever you take it and anytime you touch folks that are there. That is the definition of success. And if you can document that somehow and draw in the feeling that you have provided some kind of civic service to a world that you entered through that art, then that is success. Beyonce's former marketing person, I think he was trying to sell some kind of product, or a talk or some, you know, like masterclass. I don't remember. But he said what they did well was they identified a small subset group called a beehive that felt, this was back in the beginning, that appreciated her in a way that added value to their world, but also hers. And she found a way of giving a platform to that audience and saying, I do this for you. And that audience in turn felt like they were getting some kind of civic service through the performance of that work and their participation in it. They, as audience members, felt seen and valued. So when I look to the future, I look to projects that are doing the work of making people feel seen. Mm. And to that effect, I am happy to share a couple of upcoming projects with you.
Yeah.
One of them is I'm having a reading of my play, The Pink, an intimacy ritual, which, as we described it earlier, is an exploration of a one-night stand that lasts until the morning after for two lovers looking for transcendent intimacy. That will be in New York on August 5th in the afternoon. I don't know exactly the time, but it'll be at Caveat in the Lower East Side. So that'll be in New York. Then in September, I will have another showing in New York. Very exciting. I can say that there might be some A-list queer folks in the piece. I cannot say any names because I have not confirmed them yet, but I am really excited to be introducing to the New York market my play, The Pride of Lions. We will do a reading of that on Monday, September 23rd at, I think, 3 p.m. It'll be in New York at the Mary Rogers Room, which is part of the Dramatists Guild of America. It's a very small house, honey, so you got to reserve in advance. And then next year, well, then Lavender Men, my film, the film adaptation, premieres in August on the 5th. No, on the 9th of August in Durham, North Carolina. You'll have to look at Out South Film Festival for that. And then more long term, I know I've put a lot of stuff in your audience's brains already, but the last thing I'll say is I have written a trilogy of plays about Western expansion and the power of greed in California, the corrosive power of greed. And it's called the Caliphus Trilogy. And I'm going to be premiering that trilogy. I'm partnering with a couple of theaters in LA to do three locations, three productions of that trilogy all around the city from May to June of 2025. So you'll have to check out my Instagram because we'll probably announce all of that in the new year more formally. But I've been working on that trilogy for 10 years and I'm from LA and I've watched this city bulldoze its history in place of multi-use commercial buildings and really erode the fabric of its beauty and its majesty. And I just found myself wondering, was it all worth it? When nothing is left, who will you be? And so from that place, I started writing this trilogy about California, the land of dreams. And, you know, that's all I can talk about now. There's probably other things going on, but, you know, those are the ones my mind is focused on today. So there you go.
That's amazing. I'm glad we all have it all recorded so I can rewind and
yeah, record and rewound. Rewind. Because I've got so much going on. If you ask me tomorrow, I'd say, child, where are we going tomorrow? Okay, great.
Ah, that's amazing. Well, I'm very inspired by how much work you're creating and you're really, you know, not sitting on your laurels at all.
No. Like,
you are out there telling your stories and we need more stories like this and I'm excited and I'm inspired. So,
well, thank you very much, Andrew, for having me. And I have to say I have had a great time in the Rainbow Room.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for joining, Roger. Thank you to our audience for listening. And until next time, this has been the Rainbow Room.
Yay.
Bye.
Bye, y'all.
That's all for this week. If you like the podcast, the best way you can support us is by recommending us to others. You can also subscribe to us and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube by searching Rainbow Room Podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Rainbow Room Podcast and Twitter at Rainbow_Room_. Thanks for listening. See you next week.